This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFK. If you're not already a member, consider joining with us and keep free speech alive.
Well, thank you very much, Michael, for having me. It's a real pleasure.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this. You know, what was it? You wrote this article that's a really thorough and very compelling and enraging article, actually. Not the article itself, but what you've actually pointed to. If you read this article and you don't get mad, there's something wrong with you. Or your lips are so quick sealed to the posteriors of the imperialists that you just can't think right. You know, that's a problem. So what drove you to write this article, The Top 10 Myths in the War Against Libya?
Well, the main problem that I began with, you know, months back when the protests in Libya first began, I was frankly quite open and sympathetic to the fact that there could have been a grassroots popular protest against an authoritarian regime, and that these people would possibly offer Libya something much better. I had no idea of what was coming next. I began to suspect something was up when NATO began to hold deliberations about getting involved. And this suddenly seemed to take a very different turn from the other so-called revolutions in the Middle East and North Africa. And the justifications that NATO began to use to justify, to rationalize its involvement and to possibly take over the situation from what were then called protesters, later called rebels, and so on. And I was interested in seeing what kinds of arguments they would be using and what kinds of arguments their Libyan partners would use to justify such a extremely serious step as military intervention. And, in fact, rerouting the revolution through foreign military intervention. So then that is what started me off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's actually, it's extremely important because these aren't just things that sort of cropped up on their own. This is actually, these myths that you've listed they have been voiced and fought for and popularized by NATO, by European leaders, by Obama, by the mainstream media, and even, as you point out, the International Criminal Court, which is really a stunning roster of very bad organizations and people in the world, huh?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, and they've latched onto some very powerful myths that were bound to, at least to some extent, generate greater popular support among public opinion in the West for the need for involvement, the need for intervention, and that was certainly true at least in the early weeks of the intervention. Then support dropped off, and actually attention dropped off as well. But you're right, and the International Criminal Court in particular has, I think, done itself a great deal of damage as a result of some of the statements it's made about Libya, some of the very, very careless statements that showed that it was more of a partisan in the war than of a neutral arbiter that was interested, you know, in prosecuting all human rights abuses. It isn't. It's not interested in prosecuting human rights abuses. Mm-hmm. It's interested in prosecuting the abuses of the Gaddafi regime. The abuses that have been committed by the rebels, they're not even up for discussion at the ICC. So when you have a court, a so-called court, operating in that manner, you can't take it seriously anymore. Mm-hmm. And in fact, virtually the entire African continent has dismissed it. It has ignored its call for an arrest warrant on Muammar Gaddafi. It says the African Union is not going to respect that warrant.
Let me remind listeners that we're talking with Max Forte, an associate professor in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology at Concordia University in Montreal, and we're talking about his article, The Top 10 Myths in the War Against Libya. Max, let me ask you this, you know, because when you're telling the story, I keep thinking, okay, well, there's a very important lesson just by itself to learn, which is that imperialism is a world system, and the way the world functions, by and large, these international institutions are, you know, sort of products created to a large extent to actually organize and administer the world in the interests of imperialists. And quite frankly, it seems like that's what these things are doing. It's especially evident now in the case of Libya. You know, you talked about these 10 myths, and you said that they're, you know, Again, the importance of these myths lie in their wide reproduction with little question and to deadly effect. And I want to talk to you about a couple of them in particular, but I want to hear from you what you think is actually the most dangerous myth.
Well, the most dangerous myth is the biggest one of them all, and that is that you can have a humanitarian military intervention. That, I think, is also the deadliest one, the one that you can... And, I mean, you talk about the kind of Orwellian language that we're getting into here, the idea that you can engage in war to save lives. I think maybe 10 or 20 years ago, you wouldn't have heard such, if you pardon me for saying, such illogical obscenities being voiced. Something, I think, has happened to either the general public or to the leadership of that public that feels greater confidence in making such assertions, that you can engage in war to save lives. And I'm certain that the NATO intervention did save the lives of particular individuals. It also helped to lengthen and escalate and broaden the war so that many more people have been killed than would have likely been the case had NATO not gotten involved. And this is a case in almost every situation it is a case in every situation where NATO has been involved. NATO is not in the business of saving lives. Militaries don't save lives. That's not what they're trained to do. As much as people would like to protest and see militaries as being sort of angelic figures and so forth, that's not what they do. And so that is, I think, the most dangerous myth of them all.
Well, let's pursue that a little bit, because this has been a major argument, and it's been a major argument for many, many years. I mean, there's been these times where the U.S. Imperials have intervened, where NATO's intervened in different places around the world, and it's always been something that has caused a tremendous amount of dislocation and stumbling on the part of people who are generally progressive, generally opposed to Imperials, you know, invasions and interventions around the world. But you tack the name, the title humanitarian intervention onto it, and then suddenly all kinds of confusion gets unleashed. And particularly, I think you know, as you said, look, Gaddafi, we can talk about, you know, the one myth that you talk about there about Gaddafi being demonized or being a demon. And, you know, as you say, and I think I agree with this, is that Gaddafi was not, you know, he's hardly the demon that they portray. On the other hand, he was he's pretty bad in terms of what was going on. And that there was actually probably an element of popular content to the uprising in the beginning. But this thing of these people coming in and immediately launching, you know, just sort of hijacking it in a way and really maneuvering to have it serve their interests. I mean, even the reports that they talked about, the CIA teams on the ground, the British intelligence on the ground, all of these things going on, the use of the rebels themselves saying, well, we could have never done anything if it hadn't been for the constant pummeling given to the Gaddafi forces and to whole cities by the various imperialist air forces. You know, to me, there's actually something that you get into here, too, which is, it's not just humanitarian. It actually casts it in something that's even more insidious, I think, the responsibility to protect. And that's something that has raised all kinds of debate, which I think is good to have, but we really got to get a lot sharper on this. Here are the imperialists saying that they have the responsibility to protect, and there's so much that we could pick apart around that. We could take the rest of the show doing it, but I want to ask you what you think about this responsibility to protect cover.
Yes, well, in a way, it's a sort of renewal and revival of old missionizing ethos that was popular to some extent anyway in Europe and North America during the colonial period. The idea that it is our unique burden, you know, it used to be called the white man's burden, to save the natives from themselves, because the natives are mired in savagery and superstition, ignorance and violence. And in fact, you can almost never hear a reference to any war in Africa without it being qualified as a tribal war, because supposedly those are the bad wars, you know, not like the ones that we fight. Either a tribal war or, you know, genocide. You would think that Africa has some unique, perhaps genetic monopoly on tribalism and genocide. So to some extent, responsibility to protect to a great extent, I think it's a revival of that kind of thinking and a renewal and a fortification of it. But you're right, you mentioned at one point that as soon as you start talking about humanitarian intervention, all kinds of division and doubt and confusion begins to occupy people among what is referred to as the left politically. And this was the case also in Libya too, where the argument was, we need to save Benghazi. You know, if we don't intervene, people in Benghazi will be massacred. No evidence on the ground to support that suggestion. Worse yet is that now that the tables have been turned and we're dealing with three Gaddafi strongholds, at least three, Sirte, Sabah, and Bani Walid, all three under siege by the new regime, all three being pummeled by foreign air force. Nobody's standing up and saying, look, we have to save these cities. We have to protect these civilians. This isn't just. They're being denied food, water, electricity. They're being subjected to violence. We have already documentation of revenge killings by the rebels, in some cases such complete ethnic cleansing that they've depopulated at least an entire town next to Misrata. So in this case, we actually do have evidence to support the suggestion that, you know, there could be massacres in each of these places. Suddenly, all the so-called left people who were very much in support of protecting civilians, humanitarian intervention, you don't hear them. And I find this kind of thing, personally speaking, I find it kind of outrageous, because it is definitely a case of selective attention and of selective morality. And when you have selective morality, you don't have morality.
Well, let me ask you this, because I think it's really important what you're saying. And you know, one of the things that comes up, I think, all the time, and, you know, and actually Richard Falk made this point in a piece he wrote on this, where he said, you know, if there was any legitimacy to this idea of responsibility to protect and humanitarian intervention, one would think that there were many places in the world that could have been intervened in with a more legitimate reasoning around this, or legitimacy to that reasoning. And he points to, if there was ever a place you were going to intervene to protect civilians and to in a humanitarian intervention, one might look first to Gaza and what the Zionist regime is doing in Gaza. And,
absolutely.
Go ahead.
No, that's absolutely right. There are many cases, but it's also the way that human rights is being reconstructed by dominant Western nations, that human rights is being reconstructed to mean exclusively civil liberties. So when a state denies its people certain civil liberties, then we have a potential case for intervention. But human rights, at least, you know, when the United Nations was first established, it had a sort of broader meaning than that. It included also what we would call social and economic rights. In other words, the kinds of rights that are routinely being denied to citizens in North America every day when they lose their jobs, when they lose their homes, when they go hungry. Those sorts of rights. We don't talk about intervention to protect civilians from that kind of abuse of their rights, which are supposed to be inalienable. These are also rights to life. I mean, if you understand the implications of what going without food are. So it's a very selective interpretation of human rights that's being imposed, and that's being imposed with a success, I would think, that it hasn't had any time before. So this is also something that's relatively novel about the current situation.
Now, well, let's talk about something that's flowing from that. You know, one of the things that you point out is one of the myths is that there are, you know, most of the pro-Gaddafi forces in Libya are African mercenaries. And you actually argue that all this concentration on African mercenaries is actually a cover for what in fact is happening is ethnic cleansing.
Yes. You know, this is one of the most atrocious things about what people refer to as the Libyan Revolution. And it is not just me who's saying this. There are all kinds of, you know, the kinds of organizations that even in some cases backed intervention, such as Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International. Reporters for the Los Angeles Times were among the first, I have to say, to expose some of these crimes. And they've been persistent and enduring, and they've begun really since day one. And it serves a number of purposes. One, it serves to create, to bolster another myth that Gaddafi has no popular support. Therefore, how is he able to conduct this repression? Who are the forces? How is he able to maintain himself in power for so long? Well, foreigners. What kind of foreigners? Black ones. Sub-Saharan Africans. What are they doing? Well, they're paid mercenaries. How are they getting in? They're getting in through the airports. Therefore, we need a no-fly zone. And so, in a sense, the argument for a no-fly zone is rooted in a kind of racial hysteria. And it was racial hysteria. I followed these things actively in various social media, especially in Twitter, where the arguments were, they're coming for our wives. They're going to rape our women, which is a classic kind of expression of fear against the black male, that they're coming to take our women. And you find, in fact, even some journalists, people who I think are respected by the mainstream media, people in Al Jazeera, one who was repeating an absolute lie, which is that plane loads of mercenaries were landing from Zimbabwe. That journalist was Dima Khatib, who's the Latin America bureau chief for Al Jazeera. You had people such as Mona El-Tahawi, who's appeared on CNN, on Democracy Now! For that matter, who also repeated these assertions, unfounded assertions, about African mercenaries coming in to slaughter people. Never, by the way, never substantiated. Human Rights Watch went as far as saying that in eastern Libya, where all these alleged crimes by mercenaries were taking place, they found no evidence whatsoever that there were ever any mercenaries at all. So, I mean, it's stunning. And it's being used, and it's still being used, to round up Africans, to abduct them off the streets, to beat them, torture them, rape them, rob them, and that there have been mass killings as well. Now, all of the people who are talking about protecting civilians and the responsibility to protect, and we can't let, you know, we can't stand idly by. We're Americans. We're different, is what Obama asserted. Where are those voices now? You know, if they had spoken out now, you know, I might have been willing to treat them with a bit more respect and say, you know, well, they're credible. They're even-handed, at least. They may be busybodies, but at least they're even-handed. But they're busybodies, and they're not even-handed. So I don't think anyone here had any interest in saving the lives of innocent civilians. I think everybody was quite willing and is quite willing to stand idly by and watch massacres happen.
On that,
people ask, how can you do that? Well, you're doing it, and you're doing it right now.
And on that note, Max, we're going to have to wrap this up, but I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks. It was my pleasure.
Sure.
Thanks for inviting me.
And let me tell people again, your website is openanthropology.org, and people could find this article on that website?
Yes, they will.
And I'm telling you, if you think that what was happening in Libya is a victory for the people, you need to go to this website and check out this article, The Top 10 Myths in the War Against Libya by Max Forte, and his website is openanthropology.org. Again, Max, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay, take care.
Have a good day.
Thanks, you too. Bye now.